You're listening to episode 5 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this episode, we talk with RPG designer Shane Henselin. Running time for this episode is 44 minutes. Welcome to the Fear the Boot interview series. My name is Dan.
My name is John.
My name is Luke.
And we are talking to Shane Henselin.
Hi, guys.
Shane, before we get into this interview, we'll do the same thing we normally do. For anyone out there that's not heard of you, or anyone that has heard of you but maybe doesn't know your full resume, you want to give us a quick rundown of all the various things you've been involved in gaming-wise?
Sure. I got started back in about 1992 doing freelance writing for West End Games for the Torg line, which I just loved. And it grew from there to write for TSR. I did a bunch of Ravenloft and Dark Sun stuff. And from there, it grew into doing computer game work with a company called SSI out in California. They used to do all the cool Gold Box D&D games.
I still run D&D games in the Gold Box era. That's the inspiration for most
and
of my
And I still suffer through them.
I can't tell you how many campaigns Curse of the Azure Bonds have spawned. So.
Cool. So did Panzer General and Thunderscape and Darkfall and some other stuff there. And then obviously we founded Pinnacle and did Deadlands. And Deadlands was far more successful than we ever thought it was going to be. And that led to the whole history of Pinnacle, which is 12 years old now. Mm-hmm. And about 4 years ago, I moved to California and started working full-time in the computer game industry, which I had been dabbling and freelancing in for quite a while. And worked on City of Heroes, City of Villains, and did all the prep work for Marvel Universe Online. And then a year ago, I came to Arizona to work on a new MMO that's very near and dear to my heart, which I can't publicly announce yet. But
okay.
It wouldn't be too hard to figure out what it is.
Okay, can you tell
City
us...
City of Dead Heroes lands Marvel Universe Online.
What exactly is your role in the video game industry, or what kind of job do you do?
Well, I've had many. Back in the day with SSI, I was a level designer for Panzer General and so forth, so we'd actually use the tools, lay out maps, figure out what would be fun in a scenario. Later on, I actually did a couple of computer games with the U.S. Department of Agriculture for 4-H. They were adventure games teaching kids about water conservation and so forth. Yeah. I outlined and designed and wrote the entire game.
You could make a Doom game about that. That'd be sweet.
Plantology. Yeah. On City of Villains, I was hired to be the lead writer, and it was my job to figure out what each zone was all about, what the big stories were, and then coordinate the mission design from there. I did all the newspaper missions in City of Villains, which is kind of a proud little feat me and a few other folks did.
Love the newspaper missions.
Yeah, and I realize that if you've played it forever, it gets repetitive. But at the time, we had thousands of missions to fill and no way to do it. So me and a couple other guys came up with this kind of a Mad Lib system, which I think it doesn't suck. And we did it very quickly and very efficiently, and they were fun. And I think the text and the dialogue still holds up and is still quite fun.
Well, it's one of those neat little bits of immersion because, and I'll kind of explain this for anyone that didn't play City of Villains, but when you come in as a bad guy into the world, you, of course, want to go out and do your own little reign of terror and chaos. And so when you want to do a mission, you didn't typically get it from another character. Instead, you would whip out a newspaper, read the headlines, and be like, jewel display at local museum, famous businessman in town, so-and-so is this DA is cracking down on a crime syndicate. And you basically pick which one of those off that newspaper headlines you want to go get involved in. And that gives you a mission. And when you're doing this, your character is standing there reading a newspaper, and then he folds it up, puts it away, and you go off and do your mission and steal the gems or...
Yeah, and the idea there was that villains are proactive, right? Heroes are reactive. They go out and fight where the trouble is. But villains, they're looking for opportunities to go do things. And we weren't able to make... we had some grand plans to make that the entire mission structure. Jack Emmert, the creative director there, and Zeb Cook, the guy who did Second
Edition. Oh, yeah,
DVD,
I remember that name.
He was the lead designer at the time. Yeah, they all of us, we had a plan to do these things called schemes, and you would kind of build your missions out of tools and tips and so forth that you found in the world. We didn't have time for that. It didn't work out, but the newspaper was a bit of a last last-ditch effort to get that in there. And for the amount of time and effort we put into it, I think it worked out quite well, especially thanks to some of the programmers who really went above and beyond to get it in at the last minute. And again, it's, you know, it's because villains need to be reactive. They need to go make trouble and start fights, and that's what
we
it was all about.
We just had an episode about that.
I actually found...
We did, yeah.
Well, I always found it even visually kind of cool. Amusing because the villain that I was playing was this, like, 8.5-foot-tall lizard man, and here he is standing on the street corner reading the Morning Edition. You know, it was a neat little touch on the game.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't make a guy that looked like Spider-Man and bring down a lawsuit.
Yeah, we loved that. So you were asking me about my path here. The after we did City of Villains, I wound up being the pitch guy. So my skills in layout and design and so forth from Pinnacle allowed me to do a bunch of different pitches for different MMOs to different companies on behalf of Cryptic. So we pitched everything from different kinds of Star Wars games to Harry Potter games to internal intellectual properties that we created.
Did you pitch the next Star Wars space sim a la X-Wing and TIE Fighter?
Well, I'll tell you a little something there that I don't think is a secret. There are several Star Wars MMOs in pre-production.
All right.
Yep. Really? I don't know who has them, what state they're in. You know, it's just that's their strategy now, is that why do one? They're Star Wars. They can do lots.
That sounds beautiful to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Choice is good.
Sure as hell, I'm not going to play the one that's out now.
Why stop market saturation now?
So then I'll wrap it up. So now I'm here. I'm the creative director for Superstition Studios, and we're working on, as I mentioned, this unannounced MMO and a few other projects. And I, my job is to lay out the vision for what we're doing and then coordinate 20 to 40 people to make that happen.
Now, before we got on the mics, Luke was talking a little bit about your take on the D20 system and the fact that you think the D20 boom is kind of over. And I'm curious to hear you expound on that.
Okay, let me back up with some history. So D20 hit, and we, along with, you know, most others, figured that it was going to change the industry dramatically, which of course it did. We didn't adapt so well to it. We did Deadlands D20 and Hell on Earth D20 and even Lost Colony, which was dual statted, but we didn't really understand the whole concept of the OGL versus the actual D20 system. You know, we certainly do now, but at the time we didn't, and then, you know, I suspect it was because we just weren't that excited about it. I don't have anything bad to say about the game, it just wasn't our thing, right? So then the bad stuff that did happen was because it's an open gaming license, and this is why we won't do it with Savage Worlds, the market was absolutely flooded with 30 dwarf books, 30 elf books, etc. And there's nothing particularly wrong with any of them. Well, sure, I could name a few. And it flooded the market. And the retailers out there, because the first few things, like some of the excellent Green Ronin Freeport stuff or whatever did well, they bought tons of this other stuff as well. Well, margins in game stores are crap anyway, so when these guys got flooded with material they couldn't sell, they started going under. And they started not buying stuff like Shadowrun and Deadlands and anything that wasn't D20. And then the really bad part of that for us, besides the fact that the retailers weren't ordering non-D20 stuff for a while, is that because we did Deadlands D20 and because we did some of the dual stat stuff, even though they sold really well for us, a lot of our fans thought that we had stopped doing classic Deadlands. I remember very clearly being at Gen Con one year with a new book. I think it was Lone Stars, the Texas Rangers book. And this guy walked by and said to his girlfriend, yeah, they started doing that D20 crap. They don't do classic anymore. And I said, hey, we do too. Right here it is. This is our new book. And he says, no, you stopped doing it. What? I think I'd know.
All right. So let me ask you something. Why exactly is D20 not?
That's a good question. I can name a few things. I don't want to sound overly critical, though, because for one, it'll start a flame war, which nobody needs.
We'll be overly critical for
you. And two, you know, different strokes, right? So it's not my thing because, first off, I like exploding dice. I like for the tables at the convention halls that are our games to be the loudest ones in the room.
You said you worked at West End. Did you do any D6 Star Wars when you were at West End?
No, I did two. Two products. Okay. Yeah.
We'll do continue.
But I like those exploding dice. I like to see some guy sit there and roll a 36 on a D6, right? And he's screaming, and, well, look what I did, yeah! And that's that big memorable moment he has forever. But with D20, for example, you roll a 20 and, did you crit? Oh, no, you have to roll again. And then you roll again, and if you did happen to hit again, you get double damage. So, okay, wow, I did 6 points instead of 3, and the creature's got 96. That's not exciting to me. And probably the biggest thing overall is that is a big, thick, complicated rule book with small type. Now, I know there's tons of people that's exactly what they're into and more power to them. And I don't mean it as a criticism. But I'm a 39-year-old guy as of Monday. I've got kids and a wife, and I come home from work, and I still want to play these games. I love them. And I need to be able to create the adventure, the NPCs, and whatever I want to do in minutes rather than hours. And that's why it's not for me.
Well, two things. First of all, happy birthday.
Yes, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
And secondly, one of our complaints against the D20 system, which we have stated in previous episodes, is not per se that we don't like the D20 system itself, because I think it works wonderfully for games like D&D and also for Star Wars, though there's some internal debate about the latter one. Having said that, our problem with the D20 system was the fact that the writers within the industry and then also the fan base started trying to push everything into the D20 system. And simply put, the game system that you use in a game is going to have some impact on the feel of the game, whether that's rolling one die versus multiple dice or where you put your emphasis. And this idea of having a one-size-fits-all rule system just to us seemed very self-defeating, because one size does not fit all.
Well, I disagree a bit. I think it can be done. I think that particular system is tricky to do it. It's certainly tricky to do superheroes or ultra-realistic or lots of vehicles with armor penetrations and all that stuff, I think. But I think it can be done, and I think the trick there is to have a very simple, core, scalable spine that then lets you add in setting rules. And, you know, obviously one of the reasons I'm saying this is because we do that ourselves with Savage Worlds. So I would be hypocritical if I said otherwise. But I do believe that. And having said what I said about D20, I think what they're doing in fourth edition, from what I've, you know, seen in the presentations, which is, you know, the same thing everybody else has seen, I think they're going in the right direction. It seems to be much more simple. They're integrating, you know, kind of a fast, furious, fun attitude that we've espoused for a while. And I think the internet tools are fantastic. And it kills me a bit, because that's something I've been trying to quietly get done for about 3 years, 2 years, and I haven't been able to do so. But I think it's brilliant, and I think it's the future.
To respond to something you just said, let me amend or continue my comment on the D20 system a little bit. When I was reading some of the early documentation on the D20 system and the thoughts behind it, one of the things that they said it was supposed to accomplish was being a ubiquitous rule system, because they felt that having to learn a new rule system for every setting was putting off players or putting off potential new players. And I realize that you can add enough setting rules to a very simple spine or base system to make it fit a setting. But in doing so, you ultimately defeat what D20 system was meant to be, which is you learn it once and now use it on every game sort of rule system with only very, very minimal modifications for an individual setting. And so that's kind of where my beef with D20 came in personally. Now, I realize there's certainly some disagreement across the industry on that. And people even that listen to this show that have already told us they're going to take versions of games we're dorking around with and convert them to D20. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and I think that's a matter of the skill of the designer too, right? Some companies did it very well. I think Green Ronin did it quite well with several of their products. Several did not. I won't name any I think didn't, but, you know, plenty just took it as is and ran with it, and, you know, it didn't work out so well. But, you know, you brought up a great point though, because it is very tricky. When we were looking at Deadlands D20, we had a whole different system for wounds. And to make it feel more like our game, and we had edges and hindrances and all kinds of stuff. And as we added them, they became farther and farther away from D20, so we started saying, well, if we're trying to embrace all these folks who are into D20 now, aren't we just alienating them again and just coming up with what's really a third rule system? So inevitably, we just went with D20 as is, you know, did the best we could with our game and the feel within it, and there it was. And it was kind of bland and vanilla. You know, we didn't use the chips, we didn't use the cards, etc. And it turned out, and this was a really important, great lesson for me, that people loved those aspects of the game as much as they did the setting mm-hmm. itself.
All the accoutrements that go along with playing Deadlands that really bring in, you know, the cards, the chips. That was that was the big hurdle for me for switching over to Reloaded, but I did and I loved it.
So okay. Well, see, that's interesting too, because let me finish up real quick here. Is throughout the years over the forums and the listservs, you often hear the vocal minority who complains about something, right?
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of people will tell you that they don't like using cards for initiative. Well, when we take them away, you see how many people did love it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's also often a matter of getting them to try it. I saw somebody post on RPGNet yesterday. They said something about once your player gets the Joker when he's up against the big bad and he's shaken and he needs everything he can get, you'll never go back. It's exciting. It's the same thing as the exploding dice. It's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let me go back to something you did just mention a while ago without going into rampant fanboyism, which is probably why I'm being more quiet here, because you're doing a fantastic job of promoting yourself here without my help, because I'm a huge Savage Worlds fan. But the one thing about Savage Worlds compared to, say, D20, you're saying with D20, they tried to keep it so that nobody had to learn much to do different systems, but it turns out when you go into all the OGL variations, you would have to relearn virtually everything again except for just how to roll the dice. And I love that Savage Worlds, the mechanics are exactly the same. You just need 3 or 4 rules to kind of customize your setting, and it's a completely different gameplay experience.
That's what we try for. You know, certainly something like Necessary Evil requires, you know, quite a big expansion. Superhero rules, right? They're always a pain in the butt. I mean, we think we pulled it off pretty well. And, you know, the sales said that, you know, people didn't hate it, so there we go.
Well, my group loved it. I ran the entire campaign about 2 years ago, and that was one of the biggest hits we had. It was we've been running Savage Worlds on and off since it came out, various homebrew stuff, and that's really the first plot point we actually ran and just had a fantastic time with it.
Well, thanks.
Well, thank you for the entertainment.
Question for you, if you don't mind me asking, because this might lead into something bigger. Why the career shift from tabletop RPGs into video games?
You would be surprised how little I am asked that. When the D20 boom hit and started collapsing, it left us in pretty bad shape, and I moved on to Savage Worlds. And for me, Savage Worlds was something that I just really, really wanted to do. I didn't necessarily expect it to take off and do as well as it has. So I was kind of looking at a career shift then. I knew I was going to keep Pinnacle on the side. I probably can never, ever stop doing Pinnacle. It's in my blood. It's in my brain when I go to sleep at night. It's all I think about. I love it. You know, it's my baby as much as Deadlands itself. So when I made that switch, I'd already been looking into it, and, you know, the financial situation of the entire industry was just on the decline, and I assumed with my new game that nobody'd really heard of yet, and, you know, a lot of traction to gain against other generic systems like GURPS, and I was going to have a tough time, and I've got 2 little guys and needed to put them into college, and I had, you know, done computer games and stuff quite a bit before as a freelancer. And I knew these opportunities were out there, so I was exploring it a bit, and then I saw that Jack Emmerich, who had actually written a couple of books for us, he wrote City of Sin and some parts of Back East, the North, I think, for Deadlands.
Man, he just can't stop the City of theme.
right. He did. He did City of Heroes. So I just wrote a quick email. I was playing it with my friends, and we were loving it. I said, hey, man, great job. Good job. And I saw him at Origins that year, and he said, man, why don't you come out and work with us? And I said, oh, geez, move to California? No way. And, you know, 3 months later, I got thinking about it a little more. I saw him at Gen Con, and I said, well, maybe we should make this happen. And he was very gracious and really wanted me out there, and it worked out. And I was able to keep Pinnacle on the side, which a lot of companies would not let you do. And there it went. So it's all about the money.
That's kind of what I was going to follow up on, is being all about the money.
Deadlands, to me, is a property. It's not just a role-playing game. Now, I love RPGs. That's where my heart and mind always is. But being able to bring it, like, let's say, for example, we were able to do an MMO of Deadlands. That, to me, would be the epitome of the role-playing game experience, because while I would miss some of the subjectivity that I love from RPGs, because I'm kind of famous within our little gaming groups for Shane plans, which you would never be able to do in an MMO, because they're subjective, right? They rely on convincing the GM that this thing you're doing is cool and could happen and so on. The upside is that we can create all these fantastic places and effects and creatures and see them walking, talking, screaming, and yelling at you. And that's really, really attractive to me.
There's some concern within the RPG industry, and we've talked to a variety of people both in the video game industry and RPG industry on the subject. I want to spend the same question to you, just get your take on it. Given the move that you made, and given the fact that you even openly admitted it was about the money, do you think that right now, if we were to look at the market, that video games are solely going to take over or consume a lot of the tabletop market? That's where the money is going, because that's where the fans are going.
Okay, first off, let me say that my comment about it's all about the money was a joke. It's not entirely untrue. I mean, well, you know, I like getting paid too, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to deny that.
Right.
But I don't. It's not as crass as I was kidding around there.
Mortgages aren't paid on good intentions, and I understand that.
That's right, and you know, neither are our little boys' tuitions. And I couldn't do something I didn't like. So, you know, creating worlds is what I do, and if I can do it electronically and in print, then wow, what a happy guy I am, and, you know, here I sit. So do I think that they're encroaching on video, on traditional RPGs? Absolutely. The ability to come home after a rough day and pop Oblivion into my 360 and play for a couple of hours, or hop onto WoW or any of those things, is definitely an escape that supplants some of my need to do so through pen and paper RPGs. That said, I still personally, and all my friends, do still enjoy playing RPGs more than anything electronic. It's a social experience, and really, to me, it's the subjectivity inherent in the experience, too, that computers will probably never truly be able to emulate. But when you're all in your 30s, you don't have a ton of time, and you can hop onto one of these other experiences for, you know, 15 minutes to hours late at night on your own schedule without having to try to get 5 to 7 adults together for 5 hours a week every single week, yeah, it's going to eat into it.
Outside of the games that you've been involved in publishing, what other RPGs do you play?
Well, I played the last thing I played in California with the Cryptic folks was Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and I enjoyed that immensely. I'm a huge Dark Sun fan from back in the day, and I did some work on it. Gosh, I guess that's about it, because mostly I really do play Savage Worlds, because we have so many freaking settings, right? And I, you know, all these things right. We've got in development, I try to play at least 3 to 4 sessions of each to, I can't say that I play test every rule, because that's tough to do in 3 to 4 sessions, but we try our best to do that, but we have others who do. But what I do try to test more than anything is the feel and the atmosphere.
Has that been a trait of yours in general? Do you write a lot of homebrews? Even homebrews that you never intend to publish, or have you always written homebrews?
You know, I have. I was thinking about this the other day when I opened up some boxes for moving. I wrote the first big adventure I ever wrote was Quest for the Holy Grail for D&D, which was, I was probably 13 years old or so. And then Marvel Superheroes was this huge big deal to me because I loved Marvel Superheroes anyway. I've been reading Spidey since I was, I guess, about 6. But to me, I lived in a little coal mining town, and I didn't know that Traveler and all these other things existed, so I couldn't get them. But I got Marvel through the Sears catalog, and I was able to create Mad Max and Road Warrior and Conan and all this other
excellent
stuff in Marvel Superheroes. I actually wrote adventures. I made covers. I used their exact same formatting and everything, and I still have several of those that I made back then.
Wow. I was just asking about that because a lot of people that listen to the show, we talk a lot about BattleTech and we use D&D as a fair number of examples. And so a lot of people that listen to us assume those are the two games we play the most. But like you, I've kind of got that creative bug, though obviously I'm not nearly as published as you are. But the truth is that the vast majority of games that I play or run in a given year are all homebrew systems. And I was just curious, as someone who's actually out there and writing that, if in fact that's not something you set out to do so much as just something you are already doing and managed to find success with. And actually, maybe there's something you could talk about. How did that transition happen? How did you go from being that 13-year-old kid putting together games of your own just for S&G to actually getting published systems out there?
It was certainly a large degree of luck, but I have two fun stories there. First off, we always made a big deal about our Halloween RPG sessions, and I wound up running them latter half of college there. And one of the ones, we were playing Torg at the time, which is my all-time favorite RPG. It's just brilliant. But I did this big Halloween adventure set in the Living Land, and everybody played it. We had a good time, and they said, you know, you put a lot of work into that. You ought to send it in. And it happened to be at a time when most RPG companies were publishing quite a bit of material, unlike, you know, these days where it's a little more sparse. So I wrote it up. I sent it in. And Greg Gordon, who was the brand manager or the line editor or something for Torg, said, well, it's pretty good, but it needs this, 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 and this. So I said, okay, and I did all the work, and I sent it back in. And he wrote me back and said, wow, most people, when we give them all these things to fix, just never reply back. And I said, well, here it is. So we, you know, went through one or two more revisions, and I realized you didn't have to be a great writer. You just had to actually write. You know, keep working and learn. And I got paid $1,000 for it, and I was just thrilled. You know, here I was, a college student with $1,000 in my pocket. I was a happy guy. So then, a little while later, I did a second adventure called When Axioms Collide. Took me about 4 days to write, and I got paid $1,000 again. So I got the check in the mail, and I was in graduate school at this point, and I went to a class, a night class. Political science was my major.
Very
and
good,
my professor comes in, and he says, hey, I want to show you guys something, but I don't want you to get too excited because this is really rare, but I just got my book published and it actually made a profit, you know, in its first month of release. So, you know, we're young and naive and I'm thinking, wow, he's just got a book published. He must be a millionaire. And he whips out this check for $750. He went on to talk about his book and the 17 years of research he'd put into it. So I looked down in my backpack at the $1,000 I'd gotten for a weekend's worth of work. And I said, you know, I think I can do this for a while.
And by the way, there's a little note of advice in there to any wannabe writers. If an editor or publisher ever takes the time to sit down and write you back, they don't send you a form letter rejection, don't stop there. Follow up on that. Because if they had no faith in your product, they wouldn't bother writing you back with suggestions.
Amen.
So I don't know why that lesson is so hard to pick up, but as someone who's gotten some things published, I mean, that's easy advice right there. If an editor sends you anything but a half-page rejection letter, follow up on that. Don't get upset and give up.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say that those who don't are lazy, but I will say that doing so, and even writing it in the first place, is really, really hard work. Tons of people have great ideas. Tons of people can easily critique your ideas. But when you have a 100,000-word manuscript due, and you are writing and writing and writing till the wee hours of the morning, and you do a word count, and it's 18,000 words and you still got 80 to go, that's when the rubber hits the road and you really know who's going to finish this stuff.
Well, and also it's discouraging. It's very personally discouraging. And as someone who is a successful writer, I was wondering, do you have any stories of great discouragement on your road to success that you'd be willing to share with us?
We could call them stories of triumph.
Opportunities.
I can't say that I've ever had anything really rejected that I, you know, wasn't able to fix up and eventually get published in some form. I've certainly had, you know, the trials for me have been in managing Pinnacle, putting out a book and, you know, it not selling what you wanted, or the industry changing while you're still working on last year's model, or, you know, there was a time when Pinnacle was selling $60,000 a month worth of back stock, old books, right? And then, you know, very soon after the D20 slump really took hold and we hadn't managed it very well, you know, we were lucky to do $60,000 a quarter. So that's when you go from having a staff of 21, which is what we had at our peak, down to, you know, four or five guys working out of some, you know, crap hole basement. So it's that's the real struggles and tribulations there.
And about that downtime when you were in your slump, that was right about the time that you started thinking about coming up with Savage Worlds, correct?
Uh-huh.
One of my favorite things that actually I've read of yours is actually when you had the little design diary of how you came up with Savage Worlds that is just not online anymore, which I loved because that sold me on the game right there. Because I knew right away the thought going into it was going to be, it kind of had the same, I don't know, the goal and the game in mind was kind of the same thing I was looking for in a game. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about that since it's not online anymore?
Yeah, and if you don't mind, shoot me an email afterwards because we really should put that in an archive somewhere. It did a tremendous amount of good marketing-wise. I didn't really intend it that way. It was, you know, like I said, I was alone at that point. Everybody was gone. And it was just, you know, kind of a way for me to handle the transition. And by the way, real quick, that's when we changed to our official corporate name at the time. We closed Pinnacle, changed it to Great White Games. And I was going to run with that for a while, thinking, you know, it would be a new identity, kind of a fresh start. Mm-hmm. But you know, it turned out my name was just as, everyone still called us Pinnacle, and it was associated too heavily with me. So we've just re-embraced it, and we are officially Great White Games Incorporated, because I'm a shark nut, doing business as Pinnacle. Okay. So what was in the design diary was Great Rail Wars, I think, was one of our best products. It did really well. We sold out very quickly. The only reason it didn't continue is because of a mismanaged relationship on both of our parts with Alderac, who we were partnered with at the time.
Wait, Great Rail Wars was a miniatures game for those.
Right. It was a miniatures battle game, six factions. It was a ton of fun. It worked really smoothly, and we had discussed on several occasions how easy it would be to convert it into a role-playing game if we just really played up the edges and hindrances and fleshed out the characters a little more. And we actually had run, I think it was I can't think all of a sudden, one of our adventures.
Purple Rain.
Collegium Adventure. No.
November Rain.
No, Reign of Terror. We'd run it with the Rail Wars rules. And it turned out that was, you know, a prototype alpha Savage Worlds. But it went really well, and we remembered that. And then when I decided to kind of have this fresh start, and as much as a lot of people say they love Classic, and God bless them for it, just as many people said, you know, oh my God, I got to roll these handfuls of dice, and I can't wrap my head around it, and it's clunky, and it takes forever, and you know, that's what I hear, right? You don't hear, hey, everything's working fine. That's just like the news, right? You don't hear, yep, nothing happened today. You hear the bad stuff.
It's true.
So, you know, we decided we wanted something that was quick and fast, and maybe we could use it for miniatures games as well as card games and board games. It maybe wouldn't be exactly the same, but it'd be similar enough that people could understand one medium to the other. So I wrote about that in the design diaries, and people, it seemed to strike a chord with people, and in it also came out that we were really designing for people who were busy and didn't want to spend hours making archetype or characters like D20 kind of requires. And I made a mistake at this point, and I was called out on it. I said something about Savage Worlds was for mature gamers, and a bunch of D20 folks really took me to task on that, saying, oh, so we're immature, huh? And wow, they got mad. And you know what? I truly, honest to God, it was guys who come home from a hard day at work, have kids and a wife, and
right.
have all those responsibilities, and just don't have that kind of time. We statted out one of the 21st level characters for Lost Colony, and it, honest to God, it took us 8 hours to do it. One character. That's a lot of class switching and all kinds of stuff, but still.
Oh, yeah, I believe it.
We're into. So we did the diaries. A ton of people paid attention to them and read them, and you know, we did much better with Savage Worlds than I ever thought. And we're on the fourth printing now with the Savage Worlds Explorers Edition, which is $10, and people seem to be pretty happy. I know I am.
Luke bought me one, and I like it. I read it in one sitting. It's pretty good.
Well, lunch was on you today, then.
That's right. Maybe.
So I know you're under an NDA with your MMO, but let's get back to the tabletop RPG stuff. What do you have on the horizon that you can talk about?
Okay. For the record, Simon Lucas runs everything day-to-day at Pinnacle these days, so if I get something slightly wrong, you can check the forums or the website. I'm sure he'll correct me.
Okay.
But as I understand it, Solomon Kane releases October 20th. It's a beautiful, gorgeous book, and I'm the biggest Kane fan in the world. I have a big metal statue of Kane atop one of the demons on my desk right here I'm looking at. So that comes out October 20th, and that will be followed by other books and a really awesome screen that's something like unlike we've ever done before. After that, I believe it's January-ish, but don't quote me on these dates, is Sundered Skies, which is Dave Bluer's
Woo-hoo.
Fantasy in the Skies campaign, and Dave's just incredible.
I've been waiting for that forever.
Yeah, it's a brilliant idea and brilliantly executed. You know, it took a few iterations for us to figure things out because we really changed our focus from scripted and open to this whole plot point idea because it really seemed to work for us. And that has taken a couple of our projects, really set them back a bit. Joe Unger's Red Rising is a great example. We basically asked him to rewrite it 4 times while we were figuring out what the heck we were doing through no fault of Joe's.
Sorry to interrupt in the middle of the product update. We'll get back to that. But could you actually go into a little bit about what goes into exactly, you know, what a plot point is for those not familiar, and also just kind of talk about the, you know, the thoughts that go into making one, because it is a very interesting and new style of campaign.
It is, and it's, you know, I mentioned the design diaries before. I said revolutionary a couple of times in there, and I got taken to task on that too. What's so revolutionary about it? You roll dice, you make a character. Well, you know what was revolutionary, I think, is the same thing with plot points. It's kind of subtle, but it winds up being an entirely different experience in a couple of ways than I think you're used to. And plot points to me are the same kind of deal. So with Deadlands, we had this big backstory, and then everybody had their individual campaigns and what they were doing. And we couldn't ever quite figure out how the two should meet. And as I mentioned earlier that I was a big Dark Sun fan, they had a big backstory too, and often you would witness the events taking place in front of you. And I don't like that. You know, I want the characters to be a part of it. So where we first, I think, pulled it off probably, certainly first, and maybe the best so far, is 50 Fathom. So the world is drowning, and it's going to happen one way or another, and these events will trigger as you go about whatever it is you want to do. You will be drawn into it. You can ignore it. You don't have to save the world, but eventually it will drown. With Deadlands, the plot point books that I'm working on, it's the same kind of idea. These things are happening and they're in motion, and how you choose to interact with them is up to you. With Rippers, it's almost a, there's a lot of evil out there, what would you like to go deal with today kind of attitude. Necessary Evil is probably the one where we, you know, it may have been the weakest from the plot point of view, because again, superheroes are react. We didn't want it to be just, here's your mission tonight, because that's not really, that's not the style of a plot point, which I guess I should go back to a more general explanation. But what we intend in a plot point is for the GM to have a fast, furious, fun campaign as well as a rules system. So if you pick up one of our books and you use the plot point campaign, you should be, if you want to be, led by the nose so that you can run adventures with a few minutes notice each night. You'll be led through things to do, whether it's by random encounters or mission generators or scripted adventures or whatever it is, and there is a mix frequently within these plot points. You're going to have it all spelled out for you in quick, easy-to-run fashion. And none of that precludes you from running your own campaign and doing whatever the heck you want with it.
Which I found to be very effective in my games, because, like I said, I've run two of them now, both to a good degree of success.
Great. Which two did you do? Necessary Evil and...
Did Necessary Evil and we started Rippers. We didn't get too far in, but we started in Rippers, and it really does give the GM a lot of freedom to run what he wants, and the story, the major story arc is always there to go back to.
Yeah, and I think those two needed more polish in the plot points. I'm happy to admit that. That was, you know, transition point where we're still learning it. And plot points, the tricky thing about them, the absolute hardest thing about them, is the same model does not apply to every setting. We have to reinvent the wheel just about every time. We're finding some common points that we can stick to and do better with. But overall, they really are different every single time. That's tough.
Yeah, and like you said, with Necessary Evil, because my characters were extremely proactive, I had to rewrite the last half of a campaign because they went and took over a small country and went from there as their base of operations to fight off the alien horde. So,
and see, that's why I love pen and paper RPGs, right? You can't do that in a computer game.
Exactly.
No. Exactly.
Yeah, this was, we had an interview with Mike West, who is the script developer for Lionhead, well, one of the script developers for Lionhead Studios, and he's actually the head script developer for Fable 2. And that's one of the things that we kicked around with him, is the attraction to me of tabletop role-playing game is the infinite flexibility of the game.
Yeah.
That I don't have three options to pick from, that if I come up with some wild off-the-cuff way of solving the problem, stab the dragon while he sleeps instead of having to try to get a 40-man raid together to take him down,
yeah,
then these are all acceptable options.
They actually wake up when you zone in these days.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, there's some great attempts like Fallout, right? Fallout, I think, is one of the deepest RPG experiences out there, and two as well. But you still can't go to Europe. You can't go off on some wild tangent that's not there.
Yeah, Fallout did better. I mean, I remember solving a plot point by picking a guy's pocket and then putting lit dynamite in his pocket and walking away. And I walked a few steps away, he blew up and died, and I never even had to go through his conversation or the fight he was supposed to trigger. So okay. I'll have to give those guys some credit. And, of course, Bethesda has done a great job through their games of trying to develop what I learned in the Mike West interview is called emergent gameplay, which is where the world kind of molds and develops around you. But that technology is still, in my mind, not here. And with tabletop gaming, for me, it's not just the gameplay, but on top of that, it's also the face-to-face social contact. It's the hanging out with my friends, which is something that I just don't quite get to the same degree out of a remote play computer game, even if it is my friends and we're all in a party together and we're all on vent or TeamSpeak or whatever.
Yeah, and you never will, but those early issues you mentioned there are some of the very things that I'm trying very hard to bring to the MMO category. So we'll see how successful I am in a while.
Yeah, I'd love to talk with you more about that, but I'll respect the NDA. We actually did an interview with another MMO developer, and it was a little bit of a frustrating interview because they were great guys, very nice guys, had wonderful resumes. These are guys I had a lot of faith in, but throughout the whole interview, it was like, we would agree on what the problem is and be like, how are you going to solve it? Well, we've got this great solution, but we can't tell you what it is.
That's unfortunate.
We're not getting anywhere. So,
you know, it's not like with Pinnacle where it's my decision, right? So it does make it tough.
Yeah, I understand that. So we'll just keep working right around that. So getting back to your product release schedule, what else of note do you have coming up?
So after Sundered Skies, I understand Slipstream would be next. And Slipstream is our Buck Rogers slash Gordon space opera game. And I just love it. I think it's fantastic. I think it's going to do very well, too. And after that, I think the return of Weird Wars is somewhere in the summer of 08. And somewhere out there after that might be Red Rising. But, you know, these are the things that Joe Unger, our marketing director, is going to kill me for saying tomorrow. So there it is. Deal with it, Joe.
Yeah.
It's good to hear that some of the stuff that was announced at the beginning is, you know, finally getting out, because, you know, Slipstream and then Red Rising got mentioned very early, and it's like, wow, that sounds awesome. And it's like, please release them. We have money. We'll pay you for them. Just put them out, please.
And I appreciate that. It's frustrating for us, too. And I haven't even mentioned Deadlands books, which I'm working on, right? And I don't know exactly what the schedule there is, but the first one is The Flood, and I'm writing that one myself. I'm still not finished with it, but I expect to be done with my part here in the next month, and then it'll take another couple of months to do layout and all that. So.
Great. Well, I look forward to it.
Yeah. One of my friends is going to run a Western next year, and she's picking between Deadlands and Savage Worlds. So either way, you win. Congratulations.
Sweet.
You get our disposable income.
Yeah.
Go me.
Well, you probably can't say anything, but I've heard that Hell on Earth Reloaded is done, the writing is done, but nothing, you're kind of sitting on it for a little while. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. It's B.D. Florey wrote the first draft, and he did a fine job, but, you know, a lot has changed since he was first asked to do that, particularly the plot point stuff that we talked about, right? Like I said, we've had to rewrite a lot of things.
What's to say, you're breaking my heart, Shane.
I love Deadlands. That's what, you know, certainly has been our bread and butter, but Hell on Earth is my favorite to play, and doing it in Savage Worlds where you can have, you know, just oodles of muties and machine guns and grenades and doomsayers and worms and all that stuff. I mean, it geeks me out every time we play it. I love it. It was made for Savage Worlds.
I picked up the Unity after Savage Worlds came out. It took me a while to kind of catch up on that one. And as I was reading that, I'm like, this would be great with Savage Worlds, because you got a big mass battle. You've got all this stuff going on.
And, you know, that may be one of my favorite things I've ever written.
Well, it's a fantastic ending to that story. And while reading it, I'm like, I can't imagine running it with Hell on Earth rules, though. I mean, it would just bog down after experiencing how quickly it goes with Savage Worlds.
And it does. I ran it a couple times. And, you know, different people like different things. So somebody's going to hear this and say, ah, that was a piece of crap. Mm-hmm. But I loved it. There's a couple of things in there that I just love. There is the scene, which is my absolute favorite scene I've ever written. And, you know, when I just sit there and think about people playing that, and that's how I do these things. I envision how it's going to be when guys like you get a hold of it and play it. And that's what I love. And do love to hear your stories, actually. There's kind of that old joke, don't tell me about your character in the industry. But
that is a standing fear the boot doctrine. No gaming stories.
But I do love to hear some of these stories. And that one in particular is very cool. And then there's some stuff in there where it's just completely over the top, like the giant worm spitting the wormlings as AAA against the jet fighters and stuff. Yeah, it's just wacky over the top. It's the most over the top thing I've ever written, probably, but I love it. The downside of the Unity is that was that same period where I said, okay, this is it. Pinnacle's done. I'm going to go, you know, crawl in my hole and just do what I want for a while and see what happens. So it was rushed. And that criticism, the book itself wasn't rushed, but the storyline, you know, we were going to develop it for another 2 years before we moved on.
I got you.
And we wound up doing it in one 96-page book. So that criticism is valid. I certainly accept that. But I think, given the circumstances, it came out pretty neat.
Besides your core rule books, what is your favorite book you've written?
I'm going to have to be a little vague and give you a couple of answers. I really enjoyed writing Army of Darkness for Eden. That kind of tone is just a lot of fun for me to write. Mm-hmm. I wrote a story for The World of Darkness for White Wolf. It's in the first edition of The Beast Within. For some reason, they cut me out of the reprint. But it's a first-person, hard-boiled detective kind of thing with cynical humor, and I loved that. I wrote a novel for Blood Shadows for West End Games that I just love. It's got a cannibal horse and a gal who's really ugly, and it was just a ton of fun.
Oh, it's like a high school cafeteria.
Yeah. So I guess those are some of my tops.
Cool.
All right. Well, Shane, as we wrap this up, right now you have the ear, and I've given up on predicting these numbers because interviews are all over the place, but you have the ear of several thousand people, and I'm going to give the floor to you, give you the last word. What would you care to say to anyone that's tuning in right now? Any topic under the sun?
Okay. I guess it would be that, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you're a gamer. You love games of one sort or another. And, you know, judging by your guys' website and what you do, you're probably an RPG, maybe a minis gamer, that kind of thing, right? And as much as I'd love to tell everybody to play nothing but our products for the rest of their lives, you know, and I certainly hope they try them, don't play everything. Get a breadth of experience and try everything. And, you know, don't be so cynical about some new guy's new game. And, you know, maybe some parts of it do suck, but fix it, find the parts you love and embrace it. Even the worst games out there that I think just suck, I still have a ton of fun with the right people. It really is all about the game and the experience and the friends you play it with. And that's what it's all meant to me. And that's why I am thrilled and honored that I get any sort of attention whatsoever for the stuff we've created. And I appreciate that. So thank you all.
All right. Well, thank you, Shane. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to sit in and talk with us. And as for the rest of you listeners, we will catch you guys next time. This interview has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com.